Today's Teisho will be on case 45 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 45 is entitled, Hoen's Who Is He? Hoen of Tozan said, even Shakya and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he? Mumon's comment, if you can really see this another with perfect clarity, it is like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not? Mumon's verse, don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't discuss another's faults, don't explore another's affairs. I want to thank everybody for coming here on this beautiful, beautiful spring morning to practice Zen. And some of us have been practicing together for many years now, and it's just wonderful to be here with you this morning. I know that some of you have had a long and a challenging week, and you might be pretty tired, but you got up this morning and came here to sit, and I hope you had a good experience. The other day I was looking through a book that I own. It's the portable beat reader. It's about poets like, writers and poets. It includes Jack Kerouac and Gary Snyder and a lot of writers I admire from the 50s, and many of whom were interested in Zen, as a matter of fact. And I was reading this after sitting one morning this week. I was leafing through the book, and there's a selection in this anthology. It's got a lot of different writers. It has a lot of different writers in it. There's a selection of translations from Japanese and Chinese by a man named Kenneth Rexroth, who's not as famous as Jack Kerouac or Gary Snyder, but was part of that movement, literary movement, in the 1950s in San Francisco. And he has some translations of poems from the Japanese, and one of the poems is called, let me just read you the poem. It goes like this. The deer on Pine Mountain, where no, let me start again. The deer on Pine Mountain, where no leaves are falling, knows the coming of autumn only by the sound of his own voice. The deer on Pine Mountain, where no leaves are falling, knows the coming of autumn only by the sound of his own voice. I thought that was so beautiful. This is not just about deer, you know, but I think it's about a proper way to live. So in the poem, there's a deer who's on something called Pine Mountain, and it must be a mountain covered with pines. And because it's covered with pines, when autumn comes, there are no falling leaves. See? So if you see the mountain side and you see the pines and you see the deer, just looking at it, you couldn't tell what season it is. You know? And the deer, you know, looking around, can't tell what season it is either. But when he calls out, he knows it's autumn. In other words, he knows it's autumn because something in himself tells him it's autumn. See, you know, deer in the autumn begin to you might see deer fighting sometimes. Their antlers are out. The antlers grow all summer, and then in the fall, the velvet comes off the antlers, and the deer fight for territory, and sometimes they let out a call that you won't hear in the spring, and you won't hear it in the summer, but you'll hear it in the fall. And so if the deer's on Pine Mountain and he's trying to decide what time it is, he'll know what time of the year it is because he'll start to call. And when he calls, he knows it's fall. I hope that's making some sense. But it would be like this, you know, if you were really in harmony, you know, with the universe, when you got up in the morning, if you share a place with somebody else, maybe you got up in the morning and your housemate or your roommate says to you, "I wonder if it's cold outside." And you'd say, "Wait a minute." You'd sit down on your meditation cushion, right? You'd go, 48 degrees and wind out of the northeast. See? Wouldn't that be great? So this is kind of like that, right? You wouldn't have to go outside and check the temperature. You'd know just by looking in yourself. See, the deer knows it's fall because it comes right out of himself. You know? So this is like a little poem about being completely in harmony, inside and out, with the universe. See, so it's really quite a, I think, an incredible poem. The deer on Pine Mountain, where no leaves are falling, knows the coming of autumn. It really should just be by the sound of his own voice. You don't even need the only there. Just the sound of his own voice, it's autumn, autumn's coming right out of him. See? So it would be like, I wonder if it's snowing outside. You wouldn't have to check. You just sit quietly and go into yourself and you'd say, "Yes, snowing lightly." And it will be a little heavier later on. Yeah. But that would be quite remarkable, wouldn't it? The thing is that this is kind of like a dream. This was kind of like a dream for people in China and Japan. They valued very highly harmony with the order of, with the natural world, with the order of things, actually. It shows something about our society, I think, that we talk about the natural world as though it's distant from us. So you know, we say, "Oh yes, there's the natural world, and then there's all this other stuff." But for these people, that it was so clear that that human beings were part of nature, part of the natural order, the universe. And that basically what they wanted to do, people in this culture, was to deepen their sense of connectedness to life itself, to the mountains and the streams, to the seasons. And so a lot of their energy and time went into this idea of living harmoniously with the order of things, with the order of things, the order of the world, the order of the universe. And their word for this was Dao, or Do in Japanese, Dao. So a Dao is like the way of the world. There's a naturalness to the way things unfold. There's an order in nature. The people thought that the same order that is present, say, in a plant or a bird's song was at work in the way the stars are distributed across the sky. So there's like an order to things, see. And I think this is very profound. It's quite far from the way modern people think. But I believe that there's great truth to this way of thinking. That, you know, human beings are part of the world. They're part of the natural world. And the world is part of the universe. I mean, this is something, the other day on my computer, you know, I have a computer like everybody else, and I go online, and I was looking at the news, and they had some new photographs from space, you know, and they were photographs of just this incredible vastness, you know, incredible. Constellations, huge constellations, and like great clouds of constellations. The scale was, impossible really to get my mind around. But it was clear that it was like this enormous vastness. And this was like a cloud of universes, right? Or I should say a cloud of galaxies, pardon me. Cloud of galaxies. Galaxies after galaxy, yeah. And the vastness of it was just extraordinary. And I guess you could look at that and be frightened by it a little bit, but on the other hand, there's something I think very energizing about realizing, looking at this cloud of galaxies, and thinking, you know, we're really part of this huge thing that's really alive. And, you know, in the modern world, we might not think of it as alive. You know, we might think of the Earth as alive and the rest of the universe is somehow dead. But people in the ancient world, in China and Japan, really thought of this as like one big living thing. And the idea was, you know, to live well was to harmonize yourself with the Tao, with the order of nature, with the order of things. I think this is really valuable. I mean, every day now we read about some problem with the environment. You know, I myself was teaching a course this spring on the environment, a research writing course, and some of my students just did wonderful papers, and they really researched this. And it's the more you probe, the more you realize that we have a lot of problems. You know, if you look in the ocean, you know, we're depleting all the fish, and there's spots in the ocean because of chemicals we put in the ocean, often associated with like agriculture, where all of these chemicals wash out to sea, including things that people put on their yards, you know, like fertilizer in their yard. All that gets washed into the drains and gets washed into the streams, and it all adds up and it goes out into the ocean, and where like the Mississippi comes down and opens up, and actually where the Hudson in New York comes down and it meets the sea, and also the Chesapeake. These are rich with fertilizer, and it creates a deoxygenated zone where there's just no life. Fish won't go in there, and these are growing. You know. And we have problems with the obvious and one is global warming and so on. And the more you research this, the more my students research this, the more complex all of these problems became. And you know, it was interesting because you know, I didn't really teach the class at all. I mean, I didn't give any lectures in the class. Basically, I gave them readings that were from current books on environmental issues. So, you know, if there was a book on nuclear energy that just came out for a general reader, I excerpted a piece of that. And so I just gave them information, basically. I acted sort of like as a conduit, or I tried to. And but you know, the overwhelming impression that people came away with was that we really have to change the way we live. And so I think this idea of a Tao, of a harmonious way to live, is may return, you know, may become more important, more clear to people in our time, that we're not in, ancient people would say, we're not in harmony with the Tao. We're out of harmony with the order of things. And it's not just a matter of, you know, having a gas-guzzling SUV or, you know, maybe putting fertilizers on your grass, you know, or even maybe, you know, throwing out recyclables in the regular trash because you're too lazy to wash them. It has to do on a deeper level with our inner lives too, right? And this was something that they understood very clearly, that it wasn't really possible to be in harmony with the order of things unless you cultivated yourself. You cultivated yourself. You made yourself harmonious, right? Now this is not something that, you know, most people in the modern world really understand very, very well, I think. Because in the modern world, basically people are told that their job is to, well, if you think about it, you know, if you turn on TV or you listen to the radio, or even on the computer, you know, mostly it's about buying things. You know, it's mostly about buying things, and we want things because they will give us pleasure, right? We're told anyway that they'll give us pleasure, and we're also told, maybe not so directly, that they'll help us to be respectable and important. So most people are very eager, and there's nothing really wrong with this, but most people are really very eager to live lives of, like, you know, personal happiness through their material things. This is, you know, if you think about it, it couldn't be more obvious, right? I mean, this is all about, our culture's all about this, you know. Material things bring you happiness. And also, material things are very important because they bring you status, right? So I don't think that people on my street treat me better now that I have a new car. But when I had a car that was like 16 years old. I think people are happy on my street, my neighbors, like, to see that I have a new car. That maybe they feel good, happy for me, you know. And maybe they're relieved because my car was starting to look like a junker. Maybe they thought it was making the neighborhood look bad. And even I feel, you know, like I have a brand new car, you know. It gives you a kind of status, right? It's like I don't drive an old beater, I drive a brand new car. You know? So you might feel better about yourself. So, you know, basically acquiring things and status competition are like the central elements of modern life. And we're constantly cultivated by media, all kinds of messages all the time telling us that this is what's important. And even if you don't think they work, believe me, they're very powerful. They don't spend all those billions of dollars for nothing. They want to create anxieties, right? And they do. So, you know, modern people don't tend to think about this idea of harmonizing with the order of things. And there isn't really this idea of self-cultivation. Actually, the Japanese have a word for this, which is michi, michi. So self-cultivation. And Chinese, of course, understood this too. Most of Japanese culture comes out of Chinese culture. And, things like calligraphy is a very, very important art form in Chinese culture, writing. And people who are great calligraphic artists, you know, practice calligraphy like meditation. You know, it's not just writing beautifully. You want to be harmonious in everything you do. You know, so the calligraphy has to be done with the proper state of mind. If your mind is nervous and distracted, fearful and aggressive, you can't do calligraphy in the proper way because you're not in harmony with the Tao. You're not in harmony with the order of things. So all of the arts that emerged from East Asia are connected with this idea. The purpose of doing a painting or calligraphy in Chinese culture originally wasn't to become famous, you know. And it wasn't to sell your painting for a lot of money. It was understood to be a kind of meditation practice, a kind of harmonizing with the universe. Today, I have a lot of friends who are artists, and they have terrible mental problems because nobody recognizes them. You know, I have friends who are like really great artists. And I have some photos in my computer done by some of friends of mine. And sometimes I'll just say, hey, look at this, and I'll show somebody this, and they'll go, oh, that's beautiful. You know, who is that guy, or who is that woman? And you've never heard of them, and they can barely make any money, and they feel very impoverished by this experience because they're not well known. And because, you know, they're told a message that the job of the artist is to become well known, right? That's the point of art, is to be creative, be noticed, become famous, and get into art books, right? So they'll say art of the early 21st century, and my friends would like to be in that book. And there's like a who's who of art, you know. Actually, there's a who's who of this and that, and there's actually a who's who in the world of art, and I have an artist friend who actually got dropped from who's who in art. He was crushed. So there's a lot of pressures like this. People in China had them too, but they also had this other element to their way of life, which said, most important thing is to harmonize yourself with the order of the world. You know, this sounds great. You know, this sounds great, but you could understand Zazen as a way of harmonizing ourselves with the order of the world. But it becomes a little complicated for a number of reasons. First of all, some of you might have been watching the photographs or seeing online. The photographs of all those poor people in China from the earthquake this week. 1 minute, 40,000 people were going about their lives, right? And the little kids going to school. People were in their offices thinking, when is lunch? Right. maybe somebody was upset because he didn't get a raise, you know. Somebody else is thinking about his vacation. Yeah. And then, you know, half an hour later, maybe like 20,000 of those 50,000 people are already dead. In fact, it wouldn't have even been half an hour, right? It would have been like 10 minutes. Yeah. So you know, this is, I think, why it's hard for people to be in harmony with the Tao. That's one of the reasons. It's hard to be in harmony with the Tao. Because, you know, the idea of being in harmony with the world sounds so nice. But when something like this happens, it really challenges us. You know, we might decide this world is really just a bad place to be. You know, this is not a good world. You know, this is not a good world. And in fact, you know, many of the world's religions actually teach that this world is not a good place to be. It's not our home. You can't trust it. And it really, sooner you get out of it, the better. Also, I think, you know, like modern society is really based upon this idea, like our world, our culture, really based upon this idea that nature is has to be like conquered or subdued, you know. And I think it's events like this that that really, you know, explain a lot of why we distrust the world so much. It doesn't have to be an earthquake that kills 50,000 people. You know, you can get in your car one day and drive to work and be in a terrible accident. And there's no justice to it, you know. So we feel betrayed, you know, by the world. And so you know, it's not so easy to be harmonious with the universe. And that's a real challenge, and it's something each of us has to work on when we do a zazen. It's necessary to do zazen, I think, at least one of the reasons it's necessary to do zazen is because the order of the world is not what we think it is, you know. It's not as we imagine it. And when it seems to betray us, we're really cast into like profound uncertainty about things. But maybe you've had this experience where you sit down on the cushion, and even if something has really broken your heart, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, and after a while your anger or your fear begins to subside. And if you go into deep mushin, if you can go into deep mushin, you begin to feel kind of energy, a kind of almost like love filling your heart. This might have happened to you, you know. It's happened to me many times where things have really seemed so unfair and so difficult. And I sit down on the cushion, and I myself have these moments where I just think, you know, life is crap, you know. Everybody has those moments. And then you sit on the cushion and you think, you know, oh, this is so wonderful. You know, it's like connecting, this is connecting to the Tao, right? You know, it's foolish to think that people in ancient times didn't know about earthquakes. You know, they were just as terrible then, but somehow I think they had a deeper experience of life, you know, deeper experience of the world. And even these terrible tragedies weren't insurmountable, you know. There's another complication, though, to this whole business of living in harmony with the world. Um, you go outside after the sit, you know, you might see some birds flying across the sky, you know. This morning I saw like a bunch of geese flying over my house as I was getting in the car to come here. And, you know, geese are beautiful in flight. And you could say, you know, that really, you know, geese have a way of living, a natural way of living. And it involves, you know, flying, swimming on the water. It involves pooping on people's lawns and on park sidewalks, you know, and to drinking algae, you know, eating the algae and the plant life. And, you know, sometimes it's so clear that these geese are just totally in harmony with the world, right? They fly. Right now, you might have noticed, the geese have all had their little goslings. So yesterday, when I was coming home, some geese were crossing the street with their little goslings. And it was both the male and female, and like four or five, there were two groups. Two couples and their offspring were crossing the road, and I was so relieved to see everybody respectfully, even though this is New Jersey, you know, people respectfully waited for the little geese to get across the road. It's so wonderful. It's like, so, you know, so beautiful. The Tao, to be, you know, those geese are in the Tao, you know, they're in the harmony with the world, you know, they're obeying, you could say, nature's law. Right, and you know, it's so clear that you know, a goose belongs in a life where it can eat grass and fly through the air. You know, in my neighborhood, there's a lot of deer, and they go around and eat people's carefully planted garden items. You know, in our house, we have plants called hostas, which grow, they have long narrow stalks and then big leaves, and they're very beautiful, and the deer love them. So right now all the hostas have come out and they're very beautiful, and in about 2 months all the leaves will be gone and all that will be left is the stalks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could get mad, but that's like the Tao of the deer, right? They're forest-dwelling creatures, they're grazers. And they never travel alone. They always travel together because that's their Tao too, right? They're a herd animal, and so when they're going together through the forest and eating people's hostas, they're following their Tao, yeah, their true nature. But then, you know, when you look at human beings, it's a little more puzzling, isn't it? It's a little more puzzling because you say, how do we live in harmony with nature? And you know, of course you should recycle your things, you know, your cans and bottles. And you could, you know, basically not plant grass in your front yard. You could plant natural plants if your neighbors didn't try to fine you for doing it, you know. But on a deeper level, you know, what does it mean to be natural? And this is very complicated. Because, you know, if you think about it, it's very hard to say what is the Tao of human beings. So for example, you know, there are human beings who have who get married, and they have one spouse. Yeah? So in modern America, pretty much most people who get married are heterosexual. And so you have a man and a woman, and they get married. And everybody says that's natural. They say, oh, that's following the Tao. Okay. But then, you know, it's very curious. You know, in much of human history, people didn't actually pair off in that way, you know. So, for example, even now, many people practice polygamy, not just to people in sects out in the West, you know, like those people in Texas who who got busted. But, you know, throughout much of the world, you know, people practice polygamy. And you know what? They think polygamy is natural. You know, in many places in Africa and in the Muslim world, you know, a man might have multiple wives, might have two, three, or even more wives. And it was not easy. You know, if you're married and you're trying to support your family, imagine if you had two more families to support. It was quite hard work, yeah? And yet, you know, all of the people who lived that way said this is perfectly natural. It felt perfectly natural. You know, also, it's not widely known, but in places like Tibet, you know, they used to practice something called polyandry. And that's where one woman would marry a number of brothers. Sounds, if you're a woman, I'm sure you could agree that just sounds terrible, right? Imagine having to put up, not only do your husband's dishes, but your husband's brother and his other brother, you know, and they all throw their clothes on the ground and things like that. That would be pretty terrible if you ask me. But, you know, they think it's perfectly, this is widely done in the Himalayan region. So they all would say, well, this is totally natural. And of course, also, there are people who don't marry, who are celibate. Yeah, and they may feel, you know, this is very natural. So it's very difficult to say what the Tao of human beings is. You know, what is our natural way? You know, what is the natural way of the human being? I think it's very difficult to say. In fact, that's what this koan is kind of about. Who is he? Who is he? This is sort of like, what is your natural self? Your natural self. We say in Zen, we say your true nature. And it seems clear, right, that, you know, it's the Tao of birds to fly through the sky and build nests and have eggs. It's the Tao of foxes to, you know, come out at night or come out in the early morning and grab little birds out of their nest. It's the Tao of raccoons to eat trash out of the trash can. But what's the Tao of human beings? And this is very complicated because, you know, all of these different ways feel natural. Well, I think humans are strange creatures, actually. I really do. And I think it's stranger than we know, actually. In fact, I actually think that people are a little bit terrified of who they really are. I think they are. I really do. I think people are terrified of who we really are. You know, if you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, after a while, a strange thing is going to happen to you if you do it long enough. Your breath is going to disappear, and your mind is going to become blank and dark. And this might seem trivial, but it's really quite important. You know, when we go deeply, when we start going into ourselves, so to speak, you know, we encounter all kinds of things. We encounter thoughts. We might encounter emotions. So, you know, if you had a rough day in your office yesterday, when you came here to sit, you might have been rehearsing those events, you know. So when you go, quote unquote, go into yourself, You start remembering things that happened to you yesterday, and maybe they upset you, and so you feel some emotional, you feel upset or angry or hurt. That's part of who you are, right now. That's kind of part of who you are. But if you stay with that, if you go a little deeper, after a while that just sort of goes away. It might take a long time. If somebody really hurt your feelings, you really have powerful emotions, it might take a lot of meditation. But if you meditate long enough, all of that's going to go away, and you'll be able to come back to your breath. But after a while, even the breath is going to go away, and you're sort of left in this place that's just empty. It's like blank and dark. Zen practice is about spending a lot of time there. You know? And it might be surprising to you if you like to sit, if you like to meditate, when you go to that place that's blank and dark, the chances are it didn't bother you too much, you know? In fact, you might have felt it was very liberating. You know, I myself, when I started entering Mushin, felt very happy. I felt very rescued, you know? But there are people who encounter that for the first time and they find it very unnerving, right? Very unnerving to enter that blankness. Eventually, if you stay with it, you realize, it might take some time. I mean, some people have to work with that blankness for a long time before they become comfortable with it. So before they become comfortable with that, they fear it. It's like, for some people, going into that blankness is like standing at the edge of a big ocean with no horizon in view, right? It's like going into the ocean at night, and it's just wet and a little bit cold, and you don't know, you can't see anything, right? And it's immense. You know one thing, it's immense. So that's a little bit frightening for people, some people. But I think it's very frightening for a lot of people. You know, my personal feeling is that every once in a while people understand that this is part of who we are. And it's not just an incident. You know, some people sit on the cushion and they enter Mushin and they think, oh yeah, my mind was blank, big deal. But you know, that is, if you go down into yourself, down into your mind, what do you find? You find something that's blank and dark. We say empty. We say shunyata, emptiness. We say mu, u, emptiness, nothingness. See? Right in the heart of your life is this emptiness. Right in the heart of your being, your mind, your awareness, is this emptiness. And I think it's a little bit frightening for people. I think that people have encounters with this, just little tiny ones. And I think they run away. You know, they're very frightened of this. And, you know, maybe every once in a while we realize that there's a kind of emptiness to life. You know, in fact, many people will speak, they say, oh, something wrong, my life is so empty. See, if you've been practicing Zen for a while, you say, oh, wonderful, wonderful. See, but most people don't think that way. They think, oh, the emptiness of life. You know, when I was young, there were philosophers. There was a whole school of philosophy called existentialism. And they all said, life is meaningless, you know. It's absurd, meaningless. And they were very unhappy about it, really. You know, and they worried about it. See, they just sort of discovered, right at the center of the human, right at the center of the human being is this emptiness. In fact, you know, you could say, well, this emptiness is our true nature. Yeah? And that's very frightening for people. People do all kinds of things to avoid that. I mean, look, even Shakya and even the Buddha and Maitreya, these are Buddhas, are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he? See? And if you said, what is your true nature? You know, or who is he? You know, you could say Buddha. They say Shakya and Maitreya. So you could say, okay, who is he? To give me the ultimate, the core, the foundation, the center. Who is it? Who is it? At the center of everything. Who is it? See? You could say Buddha. But that would be wrong. See? The great master Joshu used to say, he wouldn't even let his students say Buddha. People would start to go, Buddha, you go, yeah. Say, I can't even stand to hear the word Buddha. That's what he'd say. I don't even want to hear the word Buddha, please. Okay. And this was a person who did hours and hours of meditation every day. Some people would see this koan, and who is he? And they'd say, Jesus. Jesus, of course. Allah, Muhammad. These are all symbols of something. Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad, Allah, you know, Aram, Krishna. These are all symbols of something. They aren't, but they're not it, you know. And we need the symbol because I think we're a little bit afraid of the reality. See, the reality. So if you say Buddha, you can see, a luminous being. You know, you see a beautiful, very handsome, Indian man sitting on a cushion, serene, yes? If you see Jesus, you see, you know, going with little children under a tree, you know, very calm face. If you see a Muhammad, you see somebody with, you know, resolute, lofty look on his face, kind and just. You see Krishna, joyous, you know, moving through the world with generosity. But these are symbols, and people cling to them too tightly, I think. And it creates all, you know, people become desperate, the more they encounter emptiness, the more desperately they cling to these symbols, and until all the life is drained away. And of course, when people become frightened, they become aggressive, you know? So it's not surprising that the history of religion has so much violence linked to it. But I think these are all like symbols of something that's hard for us to face up to sometimes. You know, but when we do, you know, when you go into that emptiness, when you say, okay, look, behind Buddha, behind Jesus, behind Allah, behind Ram, behind there's something. What is it? You know, and I think it's that blankness, which is not just is not trivial. It might seem trivial, but stay there for 30 years. It's like this is our Tao. I think living with this blankness is that's the Tao of the human being. So birds are made to fly through the air. And, you know, woodchucks go through the ground, you know, and chipmunks have little holes in the ground, you know, and squirrels climb trees, and fish swim in the sea. But what's our Tao? I think our Tao, I think we're the creature of Mushin. You know, I think that, you know, Mushin is our ocean. You know, Mushin is, we're fish, the fish of the Mushin ocean. You know, our life is to swim in this beautiful ocean of Mushin. And it's not, emptiness, nothingness sounds so grim. But if you stay there, it's like the most beautiful energy. Everything comes out, everything that is comes out of this is not. Everything that is comes out of this is not. And it's so beautiful to be there. So it's so purifying. And energy arises and you forgive. You can forgive yourself. You can forgive others. Your heart is filled with love, joy. So, you know, maybe we're the creature of this is our Tao. This is what it means to live in harmony for human beings. And actually, it's complicated because it's actually everybody's Tao, I think. You know, we say it's the Tao of birds to fly through the air, but you know what? You know, there are birds that don't have wings. They had wings and they lost their wings. And now they live in holes in the ground. Actually, there's burrowing birds that have no wings. Yeah? And, you know, basically, if you stick around long enough, squirrels might start living in the ocean. You know, if you wait 100 million years, there might be squirrels in the ocean. You know, maybe Mu Xin is everybody's true nature. It's birds and squirrels and, I don't know. I'll have to wait until I come back as a squirrel. And I'll tell you. But I think it's my true nature. And I hope you explore it. Hoan of Tozan said, "Even Shakya and Maitreya are servants of another. I want to ask you, who is he?" Mumon's comment, if you can really see this another with perfect clarity, it's like encountering your own father at a crossroads. Why should you ask whether you recognize him or not? Mumon's verse, don't draw another's bow, be natural. Don't ride another's horse, be natural. Don't discuss another's faults. Don't explore another's affairs, be natural, be true to your true nature. And what is your true nature? Well, please look inside yourself and see what you find there.